we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And today we are looking at the penultimate episode of Patrick McGoohan's classic 60s TV series, The Prisoner. You know, if I keep saying it's Patrick McGoohan's classic 1960s TV series, by the end of this, it will be firmly impressed in the minds of the listeners. Tonight's episode is Once Upon a Time. The new number two isn't so new. He's been here before, and this time he clearly has an adversarial attitude towards his superiors. He has been brought back to break number six once and for all. He disagreed with a technique he was required to use last time, and this time demands degree absolute, a technique that could apparently kill number six or number two. He is given approval with only 1 week, a length of time he considers insufficient. Number six is brainwashed and brought to a locked room with only number two and the butler. In this room, they recreate various times in number six's life. Number two attempts to find out what makes number six different and bring him into societal conformity. The ultimate aim of degree absolute is to make the patient arrive at a complete trust of his therapist. The danger is that the reverse can happen too. Number six's will triumphs over number two, and as the door prepares to open after their week in the room, number two dies. The supervisor enters, and seeing that number six has won, asks him what he wants. Number one, says number six. I'll take you, says the supervisor. Is number six still a prisoner?
Well, after a week locked in a room, I'd want to pee as well.
Yeah, well, he did say there was a waste disposal unit in there at one point in the little camper van that they had there in the back. I assume he meant a toilet. So we're now into the final. Some people consider it a two-part episode, but you can kind of see why it's also a standalone episode, just a standalone with a cliffhanger. So sort of a cliffhanger, kind of. So yeah. What did you make of this episode?
It was pretty full on, I thought, dramatic. And yeah, I would say it probably was part one of a two-parter. Obviously, I've never seen part two, but it really felt like it was leading up to something and left you with questions that it seemed to me needed answers. So I would consider it to be part one of a two-parter. Whether part two fits in that way is something I'm looking forward to seeing. I'm kind of itching to see it now, and I've held myself back because I wanted to talk about this episode without my mind, you know, it's an opportunity for me to kind of say what I think about it without knowing what is going to come next.
That's probably a good idea. That's probably a very good idea. Leo McKern is back as number two.
Yes, which was slightly odd, only in the at the beginning when you have the normal intro. Who are you? I'm the new number two. Well, but he isn't the new number two, is he?
It's the renew number two.
Did they just reuse exactly the same intro from The Chimes of Big Ben?
I don't know.
I meant to go and check. I meant to run them next to each other so I could see whether there were any, you know, differences in intonation and delivery in Leo McKern's bit.
But I had the same idea because when I listened to it, I felt like it was more ominous. But yeah. But it's been a while. There was some, I think the laughter was the same. That's very Leo McKern. But I think the by hook or by crook we will, he was a little more menacing, perhaps, or meaningful in it than previous episodes. But I don't know. I don't have any information as to whether or not they're different, and I didn't get the chance to check.
But it did. I mean, in terms of Leo McKern's performance, did it feel like the same number two to you?
No. I mean, obviously the words, I've been here before, he was very jovial. He was very fixated on the notion of joining into society. So that's consistent from that yes. one to this one. But clearly here he's been through the ringer.
Lots of other number twos.
Yeah. He's been through the ringer here since, yeah, lots of number twos have been on that pattern, but in his, which was, The Chimes of Big Ben, And that was the whole point of his exercise. Get in there, do something as part of the community. So that was the crux of his attack, was getting number six to adopt to the village life, as opposed to any particular effort to get him to tell, you know, why he resigned or anything like that. It was just, you know, let's get him into a pattern of normality.
Putting him in a box and getting him to fake it to Fotheringay. Somewhat elaborate scheme. I mean, I did wonder what it was when he said he didn't approve of what he'd been asked to do last time. You know, assuming that was it, was it too elaborate?
I suppose we could pretend, because we're just kind of making stuff up like they were doing. We could pretend that that's his real attitude. In other words, what he would sit and he was having, you know, a conversation with number six. I see the village as a model of the society of the world. And that's him. That's him actually expressing his view, as number two and as part of a cog in the, part of the cog in the wheel. And then the part where they get him to escape, may be the part that he didn't go along with.
Right.
So. But clearly he's been through the ringer. He's no longer the lapdog of number one, if you will. Not that he appeared to be in the earlier one, but clearly they've had, I say, a fallout. But number two seems to be on probation, almost. Like, you know, I don't want to be here. He's clearly a prisoner.
I had a slightly different interpretation of that, which was that he was in more of a position of strength this time because he'd been brought back, and he knew he'd been brought back because others had not succeeded, so they turned to him. But it was limited in the sense that when he was asking for a longer time, he was only given a week. So,
well, he was, but there, you know, when the food was brought out for him at the beginning, he was brought up almost like he was a robot being activated. I think there was meant to be some significance, maybe not significance to the plot exactly, but that, you know, McGoohan, who wrote this episode, is trying to show us a lot of ideas. With Rover sitting in his chair and him having to demand that it get removed.
But the fact is, he does demand it. He clearly has a view of a certain status that he should be accorded, which you might think some of the other number twos wouldn't necessarily hold. They would be more compliant themselves.
Perhaps.
Whereas here we've got a number two. I mean, previously he always seemed to have a pretty high degree of confidence, and now he's also got, going along with that, a sort of non-conformity, I suppose, that is perhaps slightly reminiscent of number sixes.
There's also when he goes to the supervisor and he says, you know, we're going to degree absolute. And the first thing the supervisor says, do you mind if I check that? I mean, I don't say that to my boss. you just don't, unless your boss is, you know, on the outs. It wouldn't be apply in my case, but I mean, that's really a line that says your authority is questioned here to me, which fit with that whole, I got Rover watching me. It just felt to me like they forced him back and he's playing what power he has. It says, okay, you forced me back. We do it my way. And he did at least get that. So that could be reflecting that they're getting desperate to crack number six for some reason. Because apparently they're willing to risk his actual life in this one. Not that they haven't risked it before.
But he is willing to risk it as well. So whatever position if he's in a position of weakness, or he is being maneuvered into a situation, it's his choice. He's the one who wants to go after number six, and he believes in the cause, the project, whatever you want to think of it as, enough to volunteer to sacrifice himself, essentially. I mean, isn't that what he's doing?
Yes, that's true. That's true. And there's that line about, I'm good. I was good. He's better. And if you can get him, then it's worth it.
Yes.
So skipping ahead then just to the end, did they get him? I mean, the two of them went in, and number two got broken. Is that the outcome? Is that the outcome they were looking for?
That seemed to me to be what he was looking for. That seemed to be the intention of number two. That, well, I mean, as you say, there's that kind of setup where one of them will survive, and clearly it's number two's intention that number six should survive, and he does. So from that point of view, my reading of it, and I think it is ambiguous, but it seems to me the strongest reading, is that number two achieved his aim.
Yes, at the highest cost, because there's no coming back from death. So, you know, he's willing to give it all. So McGoohan wrote this episode, and he wanted to put in a lot of... So we mentioned this before. There were, I think, seven episodes that McGoohan considers to be The Prisoner. This is episode six. This is number six. And, of course, Fallout is number seven. This was shot in the first...
It's funny that he wanted seven episodes, because it would be so tempting to have six for The Prisoner.
He put this one out under a pseudonym when it was going to the crew, because he felt very strongly about the idea behind the story, as you would expect Patrick McGoohan would feel very strongly about absolutely anything he does. because he wanted to go with some, experimental sort of theater and storytelling approaches, but he wasn't sure how well that would play with the crew and the cast. So that's why it's not in his name initially when they were filming it and working on it. They didn't know it was his idea, even though he was directing it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's weird enough that you'd want to hide it from the people you were working with?
No.
Is that because we've got 30, 40 years more, 50 years?
Possibly. It's not entirely divorced from the fact that having watched 15 episodes of The Prisoner before it, it doesn't stand out as being hugely more weird than some of the other things that have been tried out. I mean, it's not the sanest the most conventional episode so far, but it's not the most wacky or far out, I think.
It's the last episode that George Markenstein was producer on, because it was in the first block. So this was shot very early. This was the sixth.
Okay. So what you're saying then is that possibly some of the ones I'm thinking of as a viewer as being slightly more wacky were not in the can at that point. So the crew wouldn't have experienced making those ones.
Yeah, I think things like Checkmate, Free for All, Dance of the Dead, Arrival, and Chimes of Big Ben, I think, are the five before it.
Right.
And, of course, Leo McKern got asked to be back after Chimes of Big Ben. So,
yeah. I mean, I think the whole thing is something that it felt to me like you could do on a stage. And in a sense, for 1960s television to be filming something that could be done on a stage isn't that surprising, because certainly at the beginning of the 60s, that was... I mean, the feeling is to me that was what TV looked like. And the fact that The Prisoner is all shot on film, and you know, therefore this single camera approach gives you a different, more flexible way of shooting things and editing and cutting things, means that it's a more cinematic and more televisual, if you like, format than perhaps some contemporary or certainly some slightly earlier shows. But you could actually put most of this episode on in a theater, I would have thought.
Yeah, well, reportedly
lighting changes, and
yeah,
you know, even the costumes were on set on camera or whatever. I mean, I've seen plays like this. It's not that unusual in the theater. At any rate, where, you know, these constraints are imposed, where rather than being adopted, as they are in this case.
Well, apparently the first batch of episodes that they went out and made, and it's quote, this is a reported number, okay? 75,000 pounds per episode was an outrageously expensive amount.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a budget light episode for them.
Because it's essentially a two-hander.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And not much in the way of sets, very little location footage, which could have been shot at other times.
Yeah.
Well, although this was done in that production block, so they were out there for it. But, and according to McGoohan, he didn't know where it was going to finish when he wrote this one. So that's, he didn't quite, he had an idea where he was going, but it wasn't exactly fixed down just yet.
Uh-huh.
So, and I kind of think that shows. You walk out of this episode and you're like, all right, well, it doesn't really seem like we can get a very prisonery ending out of this at this point, because once number one is revealed, if indeed number one gets revealed in the next episode, which, you know, that's the promise. Mm-hmm. What are they going to do in an hour to resolve this problem? So,
well, I mean, in a way, that the whole question is this is build up to that reveal. You could have done the whole thing a lot more quickly, of course, and had that conclusion take up part of this episode, because if when it comes down to it, it's a face-off and one of them has to die. They didn't have to take the best part of an hour dueling it out. What you actually get is a kind of very... I mean, say it could have been done on stage. It is stagey. It is very theatrical. And it's the two of them dueling it out, basically.
Mm-hmm. But the duel itself is kind of...
It's an acting duel. Trying to see who can overact the other.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a series of scenes pulled out of his life. And I don't even really necessarily get the point where, you know, there are times where he is building up this dialogue and this fantasy, if you will, the fantasy that you're in school, or the fantasy that you're flying a plane, or prisoner of war, or whatever it happens to be that number two is putting himself in a position with. The moments when he suddenly seems to think the moment is right and he goes, "Why did you resign?" don't make a lot of sense to me.
You mean, why does he choose those moments?
Yes. Why does he think that was the moment when number six was ready to crack? I just didn't quite get it. It just seemed like, oh, we're gonna shout a little bit and then I'm gonna try the "why did he resign" again, just to see if this is the moment. But it didn't really seem like it was a logical moment to do it.
No, I probably agree that it felt like maybe that little scene had played out and it was time to get a new costume on or
yeah.
I mean, that sounds quite critical. I thought it was really, really good. I mean, I think they were overacting, but the fact was that it's quite a tough thing to sell, that whole playing a character and having these little scenes and bringing number six's past to life like that without, you know, the TV or at least the cinema convention would have been, you have a flashback at that point, you know, you take it back and you actually see his past. And obviously you're not getting that. You're getting a theatrical version of the same. And yet I thought they made it really compelling. And I didn't know that McGoohan had directed this, because some of the ones that McGoohan has directed I've been quite critical of. But I did make a note that I thought that the direction in this was absolutely superb. All round it was superb. The editing, the design, the lighting and sound design were all top notch in this. So it's a really, really good, well made episode, I think.
Hmm. Now, one of the things that is mentioned in some of the interviews is that McGoohan has expressed a strong interest in the work of Harold Pinter, playwright, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his comments was, Harold is talking about morality and social commentary. McGowan said, Harold Pinter does it in everything that he does, but he does it on the domestic level. I think he's a marvelous writer, but I've never been in one of his plays. So there's an in reference to this. So this is some sort of, he's trying to bring some of these ideas in. I'm not too familiar with Harold Pinter's work, so therefore I can't comment on it. But whether or not he was successful or whether this was his attempt to get him to put him in a play. It's like, see, I can do play. I can do the stage. Look, stage.
Had he done much theater work at this point?
I really don't know. I suppose we could look it up. Patrick McGowan has done an awful lot of work. But I don't know if he was a stage player. Wow. I don't know if that guy could be a stage player. He seems pretty uptight. I feel like they probably have to cut the cameras quite a bit to accommodate him.
The other kind of very theatrical device used in this was nicking a load of As You Like It, or should we say letting the Seven Ages of Man inspire the vignettes that we see in this. And I did think he must have been really cursing that there weren't six.
they were really emphasizing that he just wouldn't even say the word six, which I assume therefore is a metaphor to him accepting his identity
which I assumed was something to do with the conditioning that the pulsing light that had regressed him had done. It somehow
was still coming through from his adult mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't know, have we ever been anywhere else in the series where he refused to say the number six?
Not to my recollection. It's not as a number that he wouldn't have that as a problem per se. Obviously, in fact, I'm pretty sure he has to other members of the village. He has introduced himself as number six.
I don't know. And I'm now wondering if I have to watch the whole show again and see if he has never actually said the number six, because you could do
I'm sure he has. I'm sure in one of the early episodes, I think I may have made reference to it in a podcast that he does say that he is number six, but I couldn't put my finger on which one it was, and therefore I can't actually check that I'm correct about that.
I mean, there's the episode where they call him on the phone and the person point blank asks him, is this number six? And his response is, that's the number of this place. So he did.
The point I made, or the point I'm trying to recollect having made, was to do with inconsistency. So there's obviously that whole I'm not a number thing. But what seems to be happening here is that, as you say, what's bleeding through is his reluctance to accept number six that we have seen before. That, you know, that has clearly been there, that he's reluctant to accept number six as an identity, is bleeding through in the form that he somehow has a recollection of pushing away number six, even if he doesn't remember why. He doesn't want to say the number.
Hmm.
So that much comes across
in the seven ages that we're talking about him going through. Do you think that those were vignettes from his actual life, or is that a constructed one that number two led him through? I mean, do you think he was took a job at a bank, and then after he took the job at a bank, they revealed, actually, we're a secret agent firm, and we've been looking for you, kind of thing? You do? Okay.
I don't understand how it would make sense to create false memories for him. Well, I don't know how that would work. I don't know what they would hope to achieve by that. And one presumes that number two has pretty much full access to his entire past, because they seem to be pretty well-resourced organization. So you'd think they would be able to dig that stuff out and recreate it if need be. So
he's 9 days in front of the headmaster, refusing to tell who was talking in class. That's him?
That was certainly my interpretation of it.
I wasn't sure if they were putting it in his mind as a, you know, a possible thing that might have happened to you. I kind of never really imagined him being a bomber in the war, in World War II at that, and a prisoner of war. Because is he the right age for that?
Do we know how old he was in 67?
I'm sure we can.
I was assuming around 40-ish, so yes, he would be about the right age.
Yeah,
maybe a little young, unless he... Well, depends whether he was 40 or a little older than 40. Bearing in mind, I'm no good on ages.
It's very hard to... It's also very hard to look back at a show like this and from the 60s and remember how close the war was.
Yes.
You know, I was watching something the other day that was shot in the early 70s, and you know they're dealing with a war hero, and the war hero they're talking about the Korean War, and like, yeah, but when I think of someone who would be roughly that age, you'd be thinking of, say, the Vietnam War or, you know, one of these other skirmishes that have happened along the way. And so when somebody says, yeah, he fought in the war, you have to fix him. And Britain was involved in the Korean War, as I recall, or the Korean police action, I should say. They certainly had some troops there, which would have only been 10 years prior to this episode. That would have seemed more, well, I don't know.
Well, McGurn was born in 28, I've just checked. So he would have been 11 when the war broke out, and therefore he'd have been 17 when the war ended. So it's not impossible that he could have played a role in it, but equally that he could be playing a character who is slightly older than he is.
That's
as an
true.
Actor. His Wikipedia entry doesn't mention McGurn himself ever having done any war service, though it does, in relation to the question we were raising earlier, mention his stage work, in that he was spotted in a West End production of Serious Charge by Orson Welles in 55. So, yes, he is a stage actor.
I thought, I mean, I don't know, but I just thought all British actors were at one point stage actors back in the 60s. So,
well, it's a fair guess.
I thought that was the rule.
TV went fishing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I thought that was the rule. So we've got the central question of the episode seems to be, why do you care? That's what number two is shouting at number six at the beginning of this, even though he really can't hear it. So it seems to me like he's trying to find the grain in his character as to why he cares whether they know anything or not. Did we get an answer? Did we get an answer why he resigned? Because eventually he does say, for peace of mind.
I don't know. It would fit. But I don't trust him to give an honest answer.
It's consistent with his answer in Chimes of Big Ben. Remember, he started to answer. For some time now, I have begun to... That sounds like a man who's having second thoughts about what he's doing. And he also says in this episode, too many people know too much about too many people. Something like that. Perhaps not quite at that level, but he's clearly seeing Facebook, Twitter, the future, where there's just too much sharing going on, or the NSA, one of the two.
Interesting interpretation. I don't know. I think you can take that either way, because I think it would fit, but I don't necessarily trust him to give a straight answer to the question, or at least not to give number two a straight answer to the question.
If it was a straight answer, it's probably not the answer they want. But would that be a meaningful answer to them? I mean, may legitimately be, I quit because I'm just sick of this job and I just don't think we're doing the right thing anymore. Well, and
but it's not a detailed enough answer, is it? I mean, even if that's true, what does it tell you? What you would want to know is, okay, actually, let's rephrase the question. What was the trigger that caused you to quit? So when they're saying, you know, why did you resign? It's not just tell me how you're feeling, mate. It's actually what were you involved in that led to those feelings arising? Because ultimately, that's the root cause of your resignation. So was he engaged in an operation that disgusted him so much that he handed in his resignation then? Or, you know, rather than just kind of having mulled it over in his mind for a long time and then out of the blue one day just gone, right, think I'm going to resign today, but, and then jumped into his car and driven angrily down to the office.
But there could have been, I mean, we've had episodes where number two, A, B, and C comes to mind immediately, is looking to find out if he resigned to sell out. Yes. So, I mean, there's some doubt in them, you know, it sounds to me like his resignation probably said just exactly what he just told us, that it's for personal reasons. And even if they found out, okay, it's personal reasons, and so why, which, what operation did you participate in, and what was it that disgusted you so much? Even if he told them, I don't know that it would do them any good. It's like, well, I didn't like the thing with Professor Stedman? Or whatever it was. I can't remember which the brain swap guy or whatever it happens to be. Stallman. No, that's Inferno.
Yes, I get your point.
You know which one I'm talking about. I mean, it could have been any particular one, but it still boils down to, you know, that's just a line too far for me to cross and I don't want to cross it anymore.
Yes.
And so all the only assurance that you can get is it's not that I'm disloyal. It's not because I got offered a lot of money or because I've decided that communism is the way to go or anything like that. It's just like, this is not the way for me. And you don't get anything. And it doesn't break him down any further towards becoming a compliant member of society either.
Well, maybe. I mean, on its own, it doesn't. It might inform how they make their next approach, but we don't know exactly what their plans either, and why they feel so strongly that actually getting him to explain why he resigned is so crucial to whatever the next step is. Mm-hmm. But I did feel, coming back to the question of do we get an answer about why do you care, why does he care, that there were hints in it. I mean, the scene in the headmaster's office seemed to be at least filling in part of the picture.
That's the best part to me. The scene in the headmaster's is the one that encapsulates the prisoner to me more than any of the other sequences that they did with him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's like, that is his code of honor. And perhaps the reason he doesn't resign is just that. I took an oath not to reveal secrets. And even though it's not me, I'm left, I'm divorced from it, if you will, my code of honor says, no, I'm not going to do it. And it's the same with the tattletale. He just refused, you know, I know who it is and I didn't do it, but I'm not going to tell you. And, he did say six in this episode. Not just at the end. No, because the headmaster, number two, said six of the best lashes. And he says six. And headmaster says 10 in questioning him. 10. And then he goes, 12, oh, yes. Sir. Yeah. Make it 12. So he did actually repeat the number six once prior to his six die.
I remember it not him not getting six of the best. I'd forgotten that he actually repeated the number himself.
That was the one time he repeated the number. Yeah, and he changed it. So, but yeah, I like that. I like that scene. That one seemed to be the scene that says, yeah, that's his personality that we've seen all along right there.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else did we have in this episode? The butler was playing a strange sort of role. Did he not seem to be psychically in tune with everything that number two needed? Not saying he was supposed to be psychic, but I mean, number two never had to say anything to him. He went off and did whatever it was he needed to do without instruction.
I hadn't thought of it in terms of being psychic so much as there being a plan that had been shared between them. In the sense, he knew what number two was doing, and so he knew what was needed.
Yes. I didn't mean to imply that it was psychic. It's just it wordlessly was probably the better approach. And there were times when it made perfect sense that you would
We didn't we didn't see everything. There were moments when number six was unconscious, for example, when it cut to his coming round, or it cut to a different scene. So they could have had exchanges in there where they were planning what would happen when he regained consciousness.
True. True. But they were just, you know, it seemed to me like there were times when he would take him somewhere and then the butler would just, for example, he wordlessly gets out of the swing and heads over and gets the schoolboy hat and cane.
I mean, in a way, I think part of that, both from the point of view of for us as viewers and for number six as the person for whom this experience is being put on and for whose benefit this all is, was that if there had been any verbal exchange between the two of them, it would have shifted things away from that focus between number two and number six. They were always focused on each other, and that was only possible because the butler was playing this role of running around, fetching props and costumes, getting everything in the right places. Essentially, in theatrical terms, being the backstage crew, even though he wasn't backstage. But that was the role he was playing. It was a well-drilled operation where he knew exactly what he needed to do at any given time, and he handed to the actors what they needed when they needed it so that they could play their roles and maintain the drama, which was all about their focus on each other.
True. Does it make sense that number two died at the end?
It's not clear why he died. I mean, we obviously have that prediction at the beginning that either number two or number six will survive. It's a to the death kind of a situation. And I genuinely thought potentially there might be some kind of genuine psychological thing called degree absolute. So I Googled it. And of course, the prisoner came up as the number one result. It's pure nonsense. I have no idea why doing it in a week is any harder than doing it in a month or however long number two wanted, or how things would have been different if he'd had more time. But equally, I've no idea why it involved one of them dying.
So
how did number two die at the end? I didn't understand.
According to the prisoner script books, Degree Absolute is a play on Decree Absolute.
As in the dissolution of a marriage?
Yes. That's not a term we use over here, but apparently that's the dissolution of a marriage. At least it was in the 1960s. So
No, it's still part of the divorce process.
So it's a play on that. So this is his divorce from them, apparently. But I don't know that I have anything else. I mean, this opens a lot of questions. I'm not convinced that this would have worked, but perhaps I don't, you know, by the end of it, number two completely trusts number six, which is the reverse, or at least that's what we're told. I don't see how that would have happened, but I don't see what they did would lead him to crack. And even crack to the point where number six's words can cause his heart to stop and fall over dead.
I don't know, except that if that was the goal that number two intended, then he knew that was going to happen all along. And so whether he was genuinely trusting number six or whether he was pretending to, in order to put number six in the position of being the dominant one and therefore ascending to becoming number two, I don't know.
Yeah. Is he number two now? And the supervisor certainly deferred to him. The butler deferred to him as if he was in the command. So
yeah, I mean, in effect, that seems to be the outcome, that he takes over.
Which seems like a bad idea if he's not convinced that the village is a good place to be. You know, because you wouldn't want your number one guy being basically an enemy agent.
Well, presumably the process that he's been through is intended to mean that he now is, I don't quite know how to put it, but he now belongs to the village. He's now, or he's become, he's won over through this process. I mean, as I say, I don't quite understand it. You can enjoy the drama of the two men's performance, but as to exactly where it leaves us at the end of it, and whether number two's performance at the end of it was genuine, and what number six is actually thinking now as he leaves and follows the supervisor, I don't know. I mean, I'm wondering, are some of those answers going to be in the final episode? Don't tell me, no spoilers, please.
I won't tell you, but I'll ask you to make a prediction. Do you think they'll have the standard opening credits in the final episode?
Oh, well, that's a good question. No, I can't see how they could. Even if number six is now number two, how would they do the credits? Because they have to have someone to do number six's part.
Maybe he could be both number six and number two at the same time.
Nope. That would certainly fit into the whole strangeness vibe that the show has. Yeah, that would be curious. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I guess then there's only one way for us to find out, and that would be to move on.
End the recording and go and start watching it.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, maybe we should wait several weeks before we do it. Does that make sense? No, that's maybe we could you know, just go ahead and process it for the next episode of the show. Anyway, well, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
As we are almost through with the journey of the prisoner. Next time. So
it will be sad to have no more.
It's been a sadder world since the prisoner went off the air all those years ago. And listeners, I hope you will join us again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.